And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to remind you to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can be ready to jot down all the important information that's coming up in the second half. Greenpeace protesters have ambushed a ship carrying 60,000 tons of genetically modified soybeans off of Anglesey, and that's in northern Wales. On Friday morning, the bulk carrier Iolcos Grace, which had been heading for Liverpool, was awaiting the arrival of a pilot to guide her into the Liverpool docks. As the ship remained at anchor, a group of Greenpeace volunteers boarded the ship from inflatable dinghies, and the ship is unable to lift anchor to continue its journey, as this would injure the protesters hanging from the anchor chain. Five protesters are believed to be on board, two chained to the ship's anchor. A tent has been suspended from the ship's bow to protect the protesters chained there. We managed to come along the ship, side the ship with a pole and managed to attach a ladder, explained Greenpeace volunteer Sarah North. As soon as they were on board, the situation was very peaceful. The action is part of a campaign to prevent genetically modified crops from being imported into the United Kingdom and is believed to be the environmental group had been planning it for some time. A banner has been placed on the front of the ship and blazoned with the words, "Europe says no to GM." That's genetically modified materials. Greenpeace says they are not going to allow the ship to continue on her journey while she is carrying the GM grain, which they claim was destined for the food chain. The soybeans were being carried for agriculture giant Cargill, who has admitted that some of it is likely to contain genetically modified produce. Geraldine O'Shea, a spokeswoman for Cargill UK, confirmed that the cargo was a mixture of genetically modified and conventionally produced soybeans. It's all legal and has already been tested for safety, so we're surprised Greenpeace has taken this action, she said. The protesters have asked for samples of the cargo, but claim the captain has refused and locked the holds. Greenpeace activist Sarah North, speaking to reporters from a boat near the ship, said, "It is a very civil situation, but at the moment there's a standoff going on. We have contacted the company to ask them to tell the skipper to give us access. And there are safety issues involved here, not only for the crew, but for the protesters," said North Wales Police Chief Inspector John Hughes Jones. Quote, "We have a number of options, but we're currently just monitoring the situation and trying to get a picture of what's happening out there. Specialist police teams equipped with two inflatable dinghies and an underwater search team have arrived in North Wales and are now on standby at Alnwick." And here's that Arctic story. The eight Greenpeace activists have parachuted and snowmobiled their way onto the frozen Arctic Ocean to monitor and protest the construction of BP Amoco's controversial North Star project. The project is the first offshore project to be built in the Beaufort Sea off Alaska's north coast. This is ground zero for global warming. "The Arctic is warming faster than anywhere else on the planet," said Greenpeace climate campaigner Dan Ritzman from the Greenpeace camp. BP Amoco promotes itself as a green oil company concerned about global warming, yet it continues to drill on new frontiers with projects like North Star. It's time for BP Amoco to put its money where its mouth is and shift away from fossil fuels toward climate-friendly forms of energy such as solar power. Greenpeace opposes opening up new oil frontiers because climate scientists warn the world cannot burn even one quarter of all known fossil fuels without risking dangerous levels of global warming. In polar regions, global warming has already taken a significant toll as the ice pack melts and marine mammals like polar bears lose their habitat and hunting grounds. North Star plans to use an untested undersea pipeline that could expose the Arctic to 1 in 4 chance of a major oil spill, the Army Corps of Engineers has said. Based on its findings, Greenpeace will send messages and images to the world using satellite communication equipment. Greenpeace is campaigning against North Star to protect the Arctic from irresponsible oil drilling and stop global warming at its source, said climate change campaigner Melanie Duchin from Anchorage, Alaska. And in a story written by Garrett Jaros in the News Review out of Oregon, that's Roseburg, Oregon, Van Kelly is awakened by the caw of ravens at dawn. He rouses himself from the warmth of his sleeping bag and moves carefully to make coffee. One misstep in a daybreak's pale light and could end his life. But for the soft-spoken 44-year-old tree sitter from Mississippi, perched in a makeshift nest 110 feet above the forest floor, the risk is worth it. Suspended from a single black rope and wearing a flannel shirt, sweatpants, and a wool hat and socks with no shoes, Kelly lowered himself halfway down the tree to keep out of reach of law enforcement while talking to the media Thursday afternoon. "I love these Northwest forests," said Kelly in his self-described southern redneck dialect. "There are less than 5% of our ancient forests left, and we need to save them for future generations. I've been coming here since I was 17, and I hate to see our natural areas is going the way of the chainsaw. Kelly is making his protest from an ancient Douglas fir on a 32-acre Bureau of Land Management timber sale east of Glide. The 5-foot, 6-inch diameter, 140-foot high tree was standing before the first white settlers came to North America. Tree sitters first occupied their nest in the crown of a tree they call Madre Loco, which is Spanish for Crazy Mama, last July 2nd. She was named because in a big windstorm she sways and you think she'll throw you out, Kelly had said. Madre Loco, estimated to be at least 200 years old by BLM officials and more than 300 years old by environmentalists, is the center of Unit 5 of the Right View Timber Sale. Protesters chose the site because it's BLM's first Northwest Forest Plan sale to be cut in Douglas County, Oregon. The sale was blocked in court before the 1995 salvage logging rider exempted all 1995 and 1996 timber sales from environmental laws. Two young women were the first to sit in the tree in July. They vowed not to come down until the BLM bought back the sale from Herbert Lumber Company of Rydell. They came down in September, but others took their place. Kelly's only been in the tree for a few days now, but off and on, he's been there for months, he said. We'll change public opinion and they'll buy back the sale, he said. We are determined that that will happen, and we're not going to give up until they do. I want to get across to the average folks out there that these trees are their children's heritage. Kelly is no run-of-the-mill tree sitter. Like all tree sitters, he doesn't get paid for his efforts. It wouldn't be right, he said, and he lives off donations from well-wishers who sneak into the forest to supply him. But Kelly, who said he has a degree in library science from Mississippi State University, left behind a good job to live in a tree where the bathroom is a bucket and the showers won't come till spring. I've worked for 20 years on a 5,800-horsepower towboat pushing barges full of grain, Kelly said. I make good money and I get plenty of time off, and I'll go back. My family thinks I'm a nut. They wonder why I gave up money and opportunities, but they love me. The makeshift tree fort he lives in is made from rummaged plywood and plastic tarps that hang from ropes attached to a girth around the trunk so as not to break any branches. I have a sleeping area to stretch out on and a kitchen area about the same size, and there are a couple of spaces for books. Staying dry is the main thing. A big storm the other night blew off all the tarps. Being cold and wet and fighting atrophy are the most difficult aspects of living in a tree, Kelly said. He eats a limited vegetarian diet and does push-ups, sit-ups, and traverses lines tied to other trees to stay in shape. For entertainment, he reads, writes poetry and essays, and listens to the radio. He admits it gets pretty lonely, but he likes solitude, and he's adjusting. At first, I was a little scared being out here alone, but I hope to appeal to the goodwill of people. I have had a few people come by and say nasty things. Kelly said his main view is to the south, but there were where there were several clear cuts. Every time I look south, I'm reminded of why I'm here, he says. Our public lands amount to a very small percentage of our national timber supply, and we need to hold on to it. We should not rely on our public lands for resource extraction anymore. They should be for recreation. Lynn Herbert of Herbert Lumber refused to comment on the tree sitters who are illegally trespassing. The BLM is the agency charged with law enforcement on the site. Quote, we're supposed to uphold the law and fulfill the legal contract with Herbert Lumber, and there is no immediate press by Herbert Lumber, said E. Lynn Burkett, spokeswoman for the BLM. The timber isn't needed immediately. One of Kelly's support group, however, was arrested for trespassing and then released a few days ago. When Kelly asked if he has any concern for the people of Herbert Lumber who he might be stopping from picking up a paycheck to feed their families, he replied, oh, of course I do. But I like to think that we are all pawns in this. Activists, mill workers, and loggers are all the little guys, Kelly said. It's the federal government that's making all the money off of this, and I want people losing their jobs to realize that we're not after them. We're all in the same boat. Three conservation groups have gone to court asking for a preliminary injunction preventing the commercial lobster fishery around Hawaii from opening this year. The Greenpeace Foundation, the Center for Biological Diversity, and Turtle Island Restoration Network are plaintiffs in a federal court lawsuit filed in January seeking to protect the endangered Hawaiian monk seal from the impacts of commercial fishing in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. A motion filed last week asked Judge Samuel King to issue the injunction, citing new evidence linking the lobster fishery to the seal's decline. Only about 1,300 monk seals are still found in Hawaiian waters. Juvenile monk seals at French Frigate Shoals, the main breeding colony on the northern end of the Hawaiian archipelago, have been starving due to the lack of available prey. Lobster is a major component of the Hawaiian monk seal diet, containing more essential nutrients than any other prey item. Overfishing destroyed lobster stocks in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands in the 1980s. Seals at French Frigate Shoals have to travel farther and dive deeper to find food than seals elsewhere in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, where lobster fishing has been less intense. The Hawaiian Monk Seal Recovery Team, a group of scientists selected by the National Marine Fisheries Service to help monk seal avoid extinction, called last month for the lobster fisheries closure. Quote, all of the evidence shows that the fishery is helping to drive the Hawaiian monk seal to extinction, said Paul Achitoff, an attorney with the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, who filed the motion in the plaintiff's behalf. Well, we're asking the court to prohibit any commercial lobster fishing in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands this year, and we hope that the ban will continue so that both the lobsters and the seals that depend on them will have a chance for recovery. And from Philadelphia, more than twice as much crude oil was spilled in the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge near Philadelphia than previously estimated. A total of 170,910 gallons have now been recovered from an 145-acre pond. The spill, discovered February 5th by a hiker, was caused by a cracked weld in a 50-year-old Sunoco pipeline running beneath the refuge. Ice over the pond had limited access to the oil and exposure to wildlife until high temperatures arrived last week. Sunoco officials had estimated that about 70,000 gallons of crude had been spilled, but the melting ice exposed significantly more. Sunoco spokesman John McCann said the company now believes it has pumped out almost all of the spilled oil and plans to turn this week to treating contaminated soil and any remaining oil on the water surface. Creatures hibernating in the pond have now begun to emerge as well. At least 17 turtles have been found coated with oil, including one red-bellied turtle, a species listed as threatened in Pennsylvania. Tri-State Bird Rescue and Research Incorporated, a wildlife rehabilitation organization in Newark, Delaware, has been organizing the collection and treatment of the oiled animals. One red-eared slider, a non-native species, died because it had inhaled oil. Blood samples from all the recovered animals have been sent to a laboratory to check for the presence of hydrocarbons, which would mean the turtles were covered in oil while still buried underground. If animals are being exposed to oil before they emerge from hibernation, many more could die, said tri-state officials. Frogs and other amphibians, which are very susceptible to oiling because of their permeable skins, could be killed in large numbers. And scientists have created the world's first synthetic DNA. Scientists have made the world's first synthetic DNA, the molecules that form the blueprint of life. The breakthrough means the first artificial organisms could be born within 2 years and raises the prospect of humans redesigning whole species, including themselves. The DNA was created at the University of Texas, where researchers have mapped out the exact way it will be configured to create synthetic organism 1, also known as SO1. The microbe designed to be the world's first man-made creature. We are synthesizing DNA to create the first synthetic organism, said Professor Glenn Evans, director of the university's Genome Science and Technology Center. SO1 will have no specific function, but once it is alive, we can customize it. We can go back to the computer and change a gene and create other new life forms by simply pressing a button. Researchers are planning to create a series of designer bugs with super-efficient mechanisms for infecting target tissues such as cancer tumors and then killing them. Some would infect the human gut to produce vitamin C. Critics, however, have warned that the scientists risk unleashing a microbe master race with increased powers to infect humans and wildlife. The work to create SO1 is complex, but the test of success will be simple. Can SO1 feed and reproduce? If so, then Evans will indeed be celebrating new life. Opponents, however, will regard such an event very differently. Tony Juniper, policy and campaigns director for Friends of the Earth, said the bugs could present a serious threat to human health and the environment. He said, quote, "Scientists have already unleashed genetically modified organisms, and now we are seeing the damage they can do. Playing God by creating entirely new life forms could have very serious consequences, which should be publicly and fully debated." And from Washington, D.C., the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has criticized a draft environmental impact statement on the proposed permanent high-level radioactive waste repository at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. In formal comments presented to the Department of Energy, the NRC notes a, quote, "lack of an integrated and clearly defined proposed action in the EIS. The EIS does not describe and discuss the environmental impacts of a clearly defined proposed action," the agency said. "And it is not clear the DOA has fully identified or considered all the combined potential environmental impacts that could result from the repository." The nuclear agency is asking the Department of Energy to perform an in-depth, integrated analysis of a clearly defined proposed action before preparing its final EIS. In addition, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the Department of Energy failed to address the possible cumulative impacts of the repository, including future growth of cities and tribal developments and effects on endangered species. The draft EIS does not fully address the environmental impacts of the repository when added to other past, present, and reasonably foreseeable future actions relating to groundwater use, land use, and cultural and biological resources, the NRC says. The Department of Energy did not thoroughly discuss its strategies to mitigate potential impacts of the repository, the nuclear agency says, and it recommends the final EIS discuss the use of environmental monitoring to assess the effectiveness of mitigation measures. And would you like to look at the final NRC comments? Well, they're available at the following website. If you want to go, it's www.nrc.gov/nmss/dwm/eiscomments.htm. Once again, that webpage, www.nrc.gov/, and I believe it's capital NMSS/DWM/eiscomments.htm. And Germany's Ministry for Health has announced the suspension of approval for Novartis's BT-176 corn on the grounds that the action was necessary to protect consumers and defend precautionary health protection. According to Minister Andrea Fischer, who holds full responsibility for approving genetically modified organisms, the key factor in the decision is that Novartis's insect-killing BT corn contains an antibiotic resistance gene. She also hinted at unresolved questions about detrimental effects on non-target species and dispersal of the BT toxin in the soil. "We had to act now," explained Fisher, "as we learned that Novartis has applied for unrestricted approval of the seeds of these corn varieties. With the suspension of the approval for the release of BT as a genetically modified organism, such seed approvals are automatically stalled as well." Fisher confirmed that any planting of Novartis BT corn is banned in Germany immediately, and Fisher also said that she intended to open a new round of risk assessments for GMOs and invited all stakeholders to participate in this discussion. Quote, "The German minister's decision is a step in the right direction and is an important signal to industry, the public, and the European Commission," said Benedikt Herlin of Greenpeace. "We are confident that we will be able to stop and prevent the planting of GE corn in the rest of the European Union. Nobody wants this GE corn in the fields except Novartis. We appreciate that now another important member of state of the EU has recognized that this corn is a threat to human health and the environment." Fischer confirmed the German government was applying Article 16 of EU Directive 90/220, which allows any member of the state to withdraw a genetically modified organism approval if it has concerns about possible health or environmental effects of the GMOs. The suspension would last at least until there was a decision of the Environmental Commission on Germany's objections. Germany joins France, Luxembourg, Portugal, and Austria in formally banning the planting of Novartis BT corn. And West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette reports that after lobbying from the Oil and Gas Association of West Virginia, a bill originally intended to protect the Kanawha State Forest from a 150-acre logging permit has resulted in a compromise bill that threatens the forest even more. The original legislation intended to turn sole management of the 9,300-acre state forest over to the Department of Natural Resources for recreational purposes only. The Kanawha State Forest is only one of nine state forests in West Virginia where logging is prohibited. The compromise bill passed through the Senate Natural Resources Committee would have the DNR managing the Kanawha State Forests for multiple purposes. In addition, the DNR would not be permitted to rename the state forest as a state park or a state recreation area. The bill also gives gas and oil companies unrestricted access to drill and maintain their wells on the leases, including building roads and logging in the area. The forest prohibition on logging remains, but the ban is clarified to only restrict commercial logging, thereby opening opportunities for the oil and gas companies to pursue further development. The Montana Department of Environmental Quality has broken state law when it failed to require full reclamation of a mine site and must now force the gold miners to backfill and reclaim the area. This from the Billings Gazette. The National Wildlife Federation, Montana Environmental Information Center, Mineral Policy Center, and the Gallatin Wildlife Association filed suit in 1998 against the state and Golden Sunlight Mining Company. Helena District Judge Thomas Hansel said the state acted illegally because it put the company's economic interests over environmental protection when it adopted a mine expansion plan that did not require complete mine site reclamation. Quote, "There's nothing in the Constitution or the Metal Mining Reclamation Act which allows a reclamation decision to be based on a threshold determination of whether a mine operator will make a profit," Hansel wrote. Jim Jensen, executive director of the Montana Environmental Information Center, said said the ruling is good news because it shows the mining companies must pay to reclaim the lands they disturb so that taxpayers don't have to pick up the bill. The Department of Environmental Quality said it will change Golden Sunlight's cleanup plan and that the ruling would require officials to look at all future cleanup plans from a strictly technical viewpoint, regardless of the cost to the mining company. And we have news here from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. There are two bad Utah bills currently in Congress. The first bill is H.R. 3035, introduced by Representative Jim Hansen of Utah, an ardent opponent of meaningful wilderness protection in Utah, and a companion bill has not yet been introduced into the Senate. This bill would set aside approximately 1 million acres of the West Desert area of Utah as protected wilderness, but the bill is bad for four reasons. The acreage is inadequate. Some 2.6 million desert acres are eligible for wilderness designation. Much of the land is in the Basin and Range Province, yet there is not a single basin included. The basins provide important winter habitat for animals which spend their summers in the mountains and are thus a critical piece of any effective protection scheme. The bill does not reserve water rights for important wilderness uses. The bill allows military unprecedented access to wilderness areas without requiring notification of the BLM managers. The military has stated before that it has no need for this level of access and that wilderness designations have never interfered with its operations, and areas left out of this wilderness bill are excluded from further consideration for wilderness status at a later time. The Clinton administration has said it would veto the bill in its present form, but this raises the specter of Mr. Hansen attaching the bill as a rider to a military appropriations bill, which would be more difficult to veto. Mr. Hansen is a master at legislative maneuvering, so we all need to be on the lookout, so contact your House representative and tell them H.R. 3035 is bad news. The other bill is H.R. 3605 and a companion bill 2048. H.R. 3605 is a bad bill because it neglects the most important feature of the San Rafael Swell Wilderness. It is in direct competition with H.R. 1732, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. This bill is similar to one that Cannon introduced several years ago. It passed in the House, but then-Senator Bill Bradley filibustered it in the Senate, where it was defeated. Let's make sure that H.R. 3605 and Senate Bill 2048 are defeated. From Portland, a coalition of environmental groups, businesses, and churches has joined forces to push for additional wilderness protection in Oregon. The Oregon Wild Campaign, launched by the Oregon Natural Resources Council, seeks permanent protection for Oregon's public forest roadless areas measuring 1,000 acres or larger. The coalition also includes the Headwaters Environmental Center, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Patagonia, the California-based apparel company, as well as other organizations. We will also work to provide ecosystem restoration of public lands adjacent to core wilderness areas to order to heal damaged watersheds, said the ONRC website. Quote, clean drinking water emanating from forested watersheds is the lifeblood of our communities, according to Salem Mayor Mike Swaim. In a coalition member, undisturbed forests provide our very cleanest water, and we are very painfully aware that we have too few undisturbed forests left anywhere. Oregon Wild's first initiative is to encourage local groups to collect information about roadless areas that would qualify for protection. The coalition then plans to write a comprehensive wilderness proposal covering the entire state for presentation to Oregon's congressional delegation. John Muir once said that the great forests and wild places of the American West were God's first cathedrals, said Professor Russell Butkus, chair of the Theology Department of the University of Portland, another member. I can't think of a better reason to protect the ecological integrity and sanctity of wilderness. And that's about all the time we have for news. To get news and announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or send your letters to Earth First Radio. Now, we're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please, be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. And if you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer on the World Wide Web. Our web address is www.radioforall.net. That's Radio for All, the number 4, .net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need To play the MP3 files is free on the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Eon Blues. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. And I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to head out of here with a little tune from Robert Hoyt. And this one's called Quittin' Time.
I used to get excited about new inventions. I'm sure most were made with the best of intentions. Thought it was cool to put a man on the moon, but now I've begun to sing a different tune. Technology and science have become a religion, based on blind faith, not conscious decision. When answers cause the problems, it's time to stop and think. Slam on the brakes and make a U-turn from the brink. It's quitting time, it's quitting time. With time on that high-tech plantation, it's with time. It's with time on that old high-tech plantation, it's with time for good. They try to tell us how hard it used to be back when things tended towards simplicity, but our way of life is based on false pretenses. Cause look at all the unintended consequences. It's with time. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. Cutting edge, and we all say.